Blog Talk Radio.
Frontier Beyond Fear Blog Talk Radio Program. I am your host, Susan Larison-Danz, and today I'm so happy to be welcoming back to the show Dr. Alan Hunter, who I know perhaps many of you are meeting for the first time on this program. Today we're really going to explore what we are seeking when we're seeking more meaning in our life, when so many of us are yearning for something more. Dr. Alan Hunter is going to help us with this today through his recent book, Spiritual Hunger, Integrating Myth and Ritual into Daily Life. And I know we're going to expand into themes from his other books as well, such as his most recent book, Gratitude and Beyond, Five Insights for a Fulfilled Life, as well as Synchronicity, Align Yourself with Life's Flow, and other books that Dr. Hunter has written, and there are many, include The Six Archetypes of Love, From Innocent to Magician, and I know that we are probably going to touch upon the archetypes as well, because they are central to this theme, and central to much of Alan's work. Write Your Memoir, The Soul Work of Telling Your Story, Stories We Need to Know, and so many more books. Now let me tell you a little bit more about Alan. He has a PhD in English Literature from Oxford University, and he currently teaches at the Blue Hills Writing Institute at Curry College in Massachusetts, where he's a full professor. Now he is an expert in therapeutic writing, and a highly experienced spiritual counselor, and he has tremendous academic and intellectual depth, yet his work is really approached through the heart space, and that's where we get the benefits of all of the depths of his knowledge taken right through, straight to the heart, and that's where we're going to focus today. And it's not surprising because he's worked with so many people through his career. He's worked with troubled adolescents. He's taught prisoners in Massachusetts. He has helped many, many people transform their lives. And underlying all of this is a powerful message of unconditional love and compassion. If you'd like to learn more about Dr. Hunter, his website is up on the show page, alanhunter.net. And I will say there is an open chat room if you're listening live to today's show. And I'd like to encourage those of you listening to the podcast, if you have any questions, feel free to use the comment feature. This is much like a blog. Blog Talk Radio is very much an audio blog is what it is. And so I really welcome, and I'm sure Alan would welcome, comments on the show page. So now, without further delay, I'm so happy to welcome Alan Hunter back to the program. Hi, Alan. Oh,
it's such a pleasure to be talking with you again, Susan. We usually have such a good time.
Definitely we do. And I really wanted to emphasize that in all of our shows and in so much of your work, Alan, it's that heart space that is so important. And no matter what our walk of life, no matter what our studies, our work, whatever it is, we can all meet in that space of the heart. Isn't that true?
That's absolutely true. And unfortunately, it's a space that many people ignore or just don't pay any attention to because they've never been introduced to it in the first place.
Yes. Well, we all are invited, I think, to discover that part of ourselves, no matter who we are. And, you know, I just invite the audience to open up to that space as we talk today.
Good. Good.
Now, entering into this, into today, our focus is on spiritual hunger and
yes.
this concept of integrating myth and ritual. And as with most things, it's best to define our terms as we enter into this. And could you start, Alan, with expressing, when you talk about spiritual hunger, what is it that you're getting at there?
Yes, I specifically chose the term spiritual hunger because I perceive that people have all kinds of hungers. And some of those hungers are for food, some of those hungers are for money, for power, for shiny toys. They have compulsive activities, plenty of compulsive activities, everything from shopping to dieting to exercising to heavy drugs. We have all of these hungers, many, many hungers, but very few people actually say, well, perhaps what the real hunger might be is for a sense of purpose, of attachment, and of mattering in the world. And when we don't have that sense, that spiritual sense, that somehow we matter, that we are connected to something bigger than ourselves, then, of course, it makes perfect sense for us to get heavily involved in shopping or filling that emptiness inside with all kinds of compulsive activities. I teach at a college. Most of my students are between the ages of about 19 and 23, and I see many of them have a deep hunger for something. And sometimes it's not for knowledge. Sometimes
yes.
it is displaced.
Yes.
And there's the point. Just as when you are hungry, you hope to feed yourself with good food. But if you can't find good food, if any of us can't find good food, we are forced to go to the junk food, to the vending machine, to, you know, whatever fast food outlet is right on our doorstep. So I called this term spiritual hunger because I think it's necessary for us to identify the good, nourishing, spiritual food and to be able to find it and consume it, knowing that it's doing us good. Because if we don't, we'll go for the spiritual junk food. We'll go for the strange cult that insists on bizarre types of behavior. We'll go for any type of extremist, religious, political behavior because it has more attraction. It's more dramatic than what is presented to us with an empty life. So spiritual hunger, we're hungry for it, and that's why I wrote the book, to try and direct people towards what is beneficial for us as human beings operating from a heart space.
Yes, and how can we begin to step into that place of discernment? It's that word discernment comes to mind for me, Alan, is that it's so easy to really be misled or deceived or, you know, to be in kind of a fool's paradise of certain kinds of behaviors or rituals that we may pursue, and we should define the term ritual, I believe. But
yes,
how do we step towards discernment? And then I will give you an opportunity to define ritual because you've already defined some rituals already. I think so many things are ritual.
Yeah. Well, maybe I should start with ritual right there.
Yes. Why don't you do that?
Yeah. A ritual is usually an action. We do something. We might light a candle or tie a yellow ribbon or you name it. We might go to church for a wedding, for a funeral, for a confirmation, to temple for a bar. These are rituals, and they are physical expressions of a deeper myth. And the deeper myth is one that is held sacred by that particular society. And the way that it expresses this myth, this story, is through actions that commemorate it. So I'll give you a simple example of this. Every Memorial Day, right here in my lovely town, we have a parade up the main street. And the parade is to memorialize those who have died or been injured in various wars. And the veterans are on their open float and they wave, etc. This is a ritual.
Yeah.
Some people just say, oh, it's a parade, you know, we get to see the kids running around and people throw candy from the floats, etc. And they forget that perhaps there is a deeper resonance here. And we can get that resonance if we look at those veterans, some of whom are now very ancient and some of whom have clearly suffered. And I think at that point we dig into a deeper myth. And the deeper myth is one of several things. We could say, oh, the simplistic way of responding to that is to say, oh, it's a myth about military power. But
yeah.
I don't think that's at all. I don't think that's it at all, because when you look at those older gentlemen, some of whom are missing limbs, what you see is a different myth. What you see is that they responded to an inner call of duty. However you feel about that duty. Now, I don't approve of warfare. My father was traumatized by post-traumatic syndrome, by his experience of warfare, and it traumatized our family as well. So I'm not trying to say the military should or could be glorified. What I'm trying to say is that if we look behind the parade to the actuality of what does it mean to fight for what you believe in and risk your life. Now, that's a powerful myth, because it asks us questions. Is there anything that you believe in that you would risk dying for?
Yeah.
Is there? And for many people, of course, there's nothing they would risk dying for, not even their spouse or their children. They're just, okay, it's me. Me only. So I think if we look at that ceremonial, if we look at the ritual, the physical people walking by, and we ask questions about what is it telling us, it's actually telling us something profoundly human, and that is, if we are to be fully engaged in this world, we are going to find at some point something that we are prepared to commit our lives to, whether it's to a loving relationship, or to our children, or to doing whatever work it is that we feel is valuable. These are things that are worth risking your life on. And that has nothing to do with warfare, you see. That has to do with a primary human value. How are you going to spend your life meaningfully? So that's the difference, really, between a ritual, which can be misunderstood, and a myth, which is a whole network of stories and understandings that asks us questions. It asks us, what does it mean to be alive and paying attention?
Now, Alan, when you speak of the parade, there's one aspect of this that I'd like to visit as well.
Hmm.
And I believe this relates to ritual.
Hmm.
And I'll tell it through my own eyes. We have a parade in our town as well.
Yeah.
And when I first moved to this town, and actually it took a couple of years, I don't know when it happened, I went to this parade at one point, and I just thought, oh, you know, it's a parade. I thought of it at a very surface level.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, I have to tell you, Alan, I got choked up because I looked at the people, and I just felt this tremendous sense of connection and community and how, wow, you know, here is a town where people actually come to the parade, because there's so many towns where, you know, they hold a parade and almost nobody's there except for the people in the parade. So even beyond the themes that the parade might have represented, in fact, we had veterans in this parade and all these different aspects of the community were represented, there was this this heart-based reaction that I had in that moment that really did choke me up. I had tears in my eyes, and even when I think about it now, I get emotional. So what is
beautiful
that getting at? I know it's very important
beautiful
what I touched upon there.
Yes. Well, I think that's absolutely a beautiful example, and perhaps you've already stated the answer, because I think that a ritual is always, to some extent, about community. whether it's a very small community or a town. It's about saying, these are the things we value that connect us. And when we see that, it's profoundly moving, it seems to me. I mean, I get choked up at the Memorial Day parade here, you know, anti-war thinker that I am, because it is intensely moving to see those veterans, those who have served, those police officers. It's intensely moving.
Yes.
And perhaps that's the great thing about a ritual. When it works, it moves us. It moves us in unexpected ways, just exactly as you described. And when it's not there, we know it because there's a terrible emptiness. We feel we've missed something.
You know, the other thing that I realize as I think of this is it so binds us together, even if we have the most diverse of backgrounds, opinions, you know, in maybe some other context, we might be arguing with one another.
Mm-hmm.
But when we're in this space of the ritual, and just using the parade as an example, I imagine there are other spaces that would certainly, well, there are many other spaces, there is that feeling of being united through the magic of this space that we're participating in, this ritual, this event. There's a depth to it that is so greatly needed in the world, I feel, right now.
Exactly. Yes, in fact, you've just described, you know, spiritual hunger, the longing for depth and meaning. And, of course, in the book, I look at it from both sides. I start the book with a story of a young man, and a true story of a young man, Scott Cody, who starts the story describes, going to his junior high school graduation. And he walks across the stage in his little gown, and he, you know, everyone applauds, and it means absolutely nothing to him because he doesn't respect his teachers, he doesn't respect the school, it doesn't mean very much to him. Later on that same day, in the evening, his chum comes and taps on his window, he climbs out, he joins them, and his so-called friends, hand him a loaded shotgun, drive him to the place where the rival gang is gathered, and this kid, who's just that same day graduated from junior high school, is given the task of firing this shotgun 8 times into the crowd of rival gang members, which he does. And he says, that was the proudest day of my life. You know, if we don't have a healthy ritual that feels genuine for such a thing as graduation, we're going to have unhealthy rituals. Now, the topic there for Scott Cody, who was later known in the newspapers as Monster Scott Cody because of the violence of his crimes. Now, he was basically facing what every young man is facing. How do I grow up to be a man? How do I find out what it's like to be a guy and one of the guys? And the only thing he could find, in those desperate circumstances of poverty that he was in, the only thing he could find was join a gang and be meaner and badder than anyone else. If there's no positive ritual to say, this is the way to become a man who can contribute to society, what we will inevitably get, it seems to me, is negative rituals in which people seek only to build up their own ego sense of, I am to be feared, I am somebody special. And so it's the ego, the emerging adolescent ego, that is so vulnerable in this and in so many of the other rituals gone wrong that I describe in the book.
Yes. It seems that we need to have an awareness at a greater level how our society is paying the price in a way that we've abandoned ritual in many cases. And, you know, again, I have to approach this. So many people have maybe been introduced to some ritual in their lives, you know, perhaps a religious ritual of some sort, and it didn't resonate with them, and so they abandoned that, Mm-hmm. And then maybe they lose sight of what ritual actually is, because I think we have certain definitions in our head. You know, when I first came at your book, you know, I had a certain definition of what ritual is, and it was actually much more limited than how you define ritual. I mean, you really make us realize that ritual can apply in a great many circumstances, more so than I had even pondered. And so I guess what I'm getting at here is when we have experienced rituals in our lives that didn't serve us, and then we move from those, and then there's this emptiness of what do we replace this with? Could it be that there really are rituals, like the parade? You know, I may not have even thought of that as a ritual that I was participating in, and yet we have healthy rituals in our lives, just as we may have unhealthy ones as well. And it's a recognition that they are there. I guess that's what came through to me, because, you know, we may mourn our lack of it, and maybe there are more around us to access than we realize.
Yes. Well, I can only agree with that. Perhaps what I'll do is, In responding to that, I'll suggest that the lack of effective rituals can be remedied very easily, because we can take the time to slow down and have discussions about what the occasion, the ritual may demand. So I'll give you an example of this, because it seems to me that when rituals are not fully present, we have a crisis area in our society. So I'll point to an obvious crisis area, and that is, you know, if you look at the most dangerous time to be alive, the highest death rate, according to the Federal Bureau of Statistics, the highest death rate seems to be for teenagers between the age of about 15 and I think it's 20, so they wouldn't be teenagers anymore. And so you say, oh, you know, lots of them getting hurt and lots of them dying at that age. What is it they're dying from? Well, one of the things they are overwhelmingly dying from, strangely enough, is road accidents. And you say to yourself, well, how can that be? I mean, don't they all take driver's ed? Don't they all pass the test? And yes, they do. But that is perhaps the point. You can take a test, and you know, you can cram to pass the test, and you can get your license without really ever being asked to think in a responsible way about what it means to be in charge of a very large vehicle weighing 2,000 pounds that can travel up to 90 miles an hour, and so on. And nobody is getting our young people into this conversation about responsibility and power, because that's really what it is. What is power and what is responsibility? Instead of which, it's congratulations, you'll get your license mailed to you in 3 weeks. Here's your temporary permit. Off you go. And they go off and they text and they drive and they drink and they drive and they kill themselves in huge quantities, and other people too, of course, but they kill themselves. Now, that's a tragedy.
Oh,
and yet
we
can, if we engage in the conversation about what does it mean to be in charge, what does it mean to use power responsibly, we can begin to ask people to think about that so that they perhaps don't kill themselves or are more considerate. Now, other societies, in the book I talk about the ancient Greeks. The ancient Greeks had a wonderful pair of myths about that. One was Icarus and Daedalus. Icarus, the sun, and Daedalus, his dad created the wings and told his son not to fly too near the sun. And of course, because he's a teenager, he flies too near the sun and is drowned in the sea when his wax wings melt. It's a well-known story.
Yes.
And you can look at that from a very Victorian point of view and say, you see, young people aren't to be trusted. and that's you know, that's okay. I suppose that's an interpretation. Or you can look at the story and say, who gave him those wings? His dad did. And his dad gave him instructions, don't go too near the sun. or you'll melt the wings. Don't go near the sea, or you'll get the wings wet and they will sink. But what Dad didn't realize was he was talking to a teenager. Teenagers don't always get it first time.
Yes.
And so the Greek myth says it's the young man's fault, of course, he did the flying, but it's also the father's fault for not making the time to have the discussion that could have saved both of them a lot of misery.
Yes.
And it's the same myth of Phaeton and Helios, where both are punished, father and son. And so the Greeks had wisdom within this mythic story that I'm sure was connected to their myths and rituals of manhood. They would tell those stories and say, son, you're growing up, you're soon going to be in charge. Have you thought about what that means?
Yes. You know, as you're speaking of this, Alan, I couldn't help but think about something that's happening more in our culture around this concept of giving teenagers a sense of responsibility. You know, how do you communicate that? And in some ways, I've questioned this, honestly, as a parent, because I've thought maybe it's a little too extreme, and it may be. There's some balance there, but you're starting to see where they'll have these programs that come into the school, which are very much based in the heart and empathy. And you see this with a lot of things, whether it be bullying, but specifically driving. We just had one. You know, I happen to be a parent of a teenager in that age range. He's just, he had just entered into that age range, although he does not drive yet. So, you know, I live in perilous times here. But what I'm getting at here is how they had a program at their school which showed a drama, a kind of myth, a story, where these kids were shown to have gotten in this horrible accident, and they made it really real because they used people from the school. You know, so-and-so was killed. Now, they did not fool the children. I've heard in some schools they've done that. I think they've stopped that because kids were actually taking it seriously, thinking that their best friend was just killed in an accident. And I think that had dangers to it. But they dramatized it in this heart-based way, Alan, and, you know, in creating this story around it that involved the real people that they knew, although they knew it was a story, but it really drove home the themes. And I was even a little worried about it, thinking this is too emotional, this is too much. And yet now I wonder, because as you say, I mean, we're giving these kids a tremendous sense of responsibility on the road. And it's just an example, but we gloss over that. And yet we find a way now, we're trying to approach, and I see this as very healthy, a way of instilling that in an empathic, heart-based way so that it will truly be learned. And so as you were speaking, that's what came to mind.
Oh, that's marvelous to hear. I wasn't aware of those programs because you're absolutely right. Unless we make this a heart-based example or experience, it's not going to be remembered. We only remember things when our emotions are engaged. You know, if I ask somebody, what were you doing on Tuesday, the 22nd of February at 7, unless something big was going on that engaged the emotions, it's gone, it's forgotten. Of course it is. So we have to engage people in discussion of these myths. They're all around us. It's just we're not doing it. We're not using them nearly as much as we could or perhaps should do if we're actually going to value our young people. Young people are the future. They're not just going to be driving cars. They're going to be running the country.
Yeah.
we really do need to get into this conversation about, okay, so what does it mean if you're in charge of a very powerful company? Is it just about the money? Well, if that's all they've been taught to respect, what you'll get is, you know, Wall Street malfeasance and all kinds of scandals if it's just about the money and getting away with it.
Yes. You know, you're really making me think here about, in fact, this gets close to something that's near and dear to your heart, I'm sure, because you're a teacher.
I am.
is in many ways, but being a professor, but even I think about these high school teachers, anyone teaching our young people, or even as we get older too, is there's something that this even goes beyond, it expands beyond some of the themes of your book, but it's very related, is, you know, how do we convey these lessons? You know, so much nowadays, everyone's just teaching to the test. You know, I see that you talk about that in terms of driving. Well, it's everywhere.
And, it's everywhere.
And, you know, that's how these schools are being measured. And yet, what is truly learning? You know,
exactly.
I have,
exactly.
you know, I've been observing it through my own son, and when something really engages him, you know, what he really wants to learn about, and, you know, teachers help to feed that, and yet this is so related to engaging in the ritual of school, I suppose, and and how do we, like you say, these kids, they're going to run our world, and
some of them already
how are.
How are
we preparing them for that? You know, just making them think they have to pass the test, well, that's not exactly how one runs the world. And I feel like, boy, there's something really important here related to the themes of your book, and that it really does have to do with the depth of our rituals and the stories that we're conveying and how we're conveying them and whether we're still conveying them, if we've failed to convey important stories, that we've lost sight of them.
Exactly. I mean, you put it beautifully, in fact. Education these days, and this is college education and school education, teaches to the test, teaches the competency, teaches measurable skills. Now, some of those measurable skills are really important. You know, many of the students who come through my hands at Curry College are nursing students. And they have a lot of serious information they need to know. And boy, I really want them to know it, because if I'm ever ill, I don't want an incompetent nurse giving me the wrong medication or the wrong treatment or anything. I want them to be very, very competent. So that is important. Let us not never forget that certain tests that measure certain skills are going to be vitally important. And yet, that's only one side of the equation. That's only one part of what we're looking at, because we need to be able to relay these ethical and moral concerns to our young people in some way. And the best way, the very best way, has always been through story. But yet, here at the Boston Public Schools, English literature, for example, is no longer a subject. It's been lumped together, English and history and geography with a bit of social studies. They now call it humanities.
Yes.
So English stories, those stories that have helped for many, sometimes thousands of years, to articulate what it means to be human, we tend not to look at those. And actually, even when we do look at them, we don't look at them terribly usefully. In the book, I write about how, as a probably a 15-year-old, I read the Odyssey, and we were tested on, you know, what happened in this chapter and what happened in that chapter. At no point did my teachers, who were excellent teachers, at no point did they turn to the class and say, perhaps you're on an Odyssey as well. At no point were the students asked, what is it that you're looking for? And how does that compare with what Odysseus is looking for? And I think that was an opportunity missed. At Curry College, we have literature as part of the central liberal arts curriculum, but we're under increasing pressure to make it less of the central liberal arts curriculum. It's now optional rather than one literature course mandated, that kind of thing. That's true of hundreds of colleges all over the United States. But I give this personal example because I look at my students and I say, some of you folks, I say, you could really use knowing some of the classic tales.
Yes.
And when I teach, for instance, my class on the Grimm Brothers' Tales, I discover that the only version they know of the Grimm Brothers' Tales is the Disney version. And the Disney version is very lovely, and there are lots of, you know, little animals and birds chirping and wandering around, and it's very pretty. But actually, most of those Disney versions completely miss the point. And so you have, for instance, you know, Cinderella, who waits around for her prince to come in the Disney version, and there are young women up and down the country who suffer from what's known as the Cinderella syndrome, where they feel that if they just stay at home and are good, their prince will come.
Yeah.
And this, of course, makes them very, very miserable. Of course, if you read the Grimm Brothers version of Cinderella, what you realize is that she's a determined little so-and-so. She's told, you cannot go to the ball. And three times she set tests, which she passes, and they say, you still can't go. And she goes anyway. And she doesn't go once, she goes three times. And only then, when she's made contact with the prince, does she step back and see and say to herself, you know, let's see whether he's going to follow up on this. And he pursues her. You know, he makes strenuous effort to pursue her three times. So the balance is right there. Now, the Grimm Brothers' Tale, which was meant for children and young people, but of course is a favorite with everybody, that original version has a little myth in it that says, young women, if you want something, you're going to have to mobilize all your resources and make it happen.
Yeah.
And that's a very empowering story. Whereas if we take our children, and we do take our children to whatever Disney version is available at the cinema, which makes a boatload of money, but it encourages them to be pretty and passive and actually not to try. I think that is a dreadful thing to do to young women and girls.
Oh, that's awful. It's the absolute opposite of what we should be teaching them. And, you know, something you really invite us through your work, Alan, to, you know, I think so many of us, we don't have the right view of story. We think, oh, it's just a story. Or, you know, that, you know, this is so important for people who are of all ages. And I know this can be true for young people, but also for those who are, you know, my age and beyond. I'm not saying what my age is, but in middle age. Is that it's not just a story. It's not just an entertaining tale. It's not just something to, you know, to divert your mind. It's something to directly relate to your human experience, that
yeah.
these tales that we're losing sight of
yes.
within both the educational system and within our lives, within our busy lives, when we're not, you know, maybe we've read a lot of these things in our youth and then lost touch with them.
Mm-hmm.
They're really important because they have so much to tell us about ourselves.
Yeah.
And that theme emerges again and again through your work, and very much in this place with this notion of myth, because, and you even say it in this book, Spiritual Hunger, a similar thing, that, you know, it's the life experience that's reflected in these stories, that it's very
yeah.
important, and we're losing
yeah.
something by not telling stories as much anymore, and
yeah.
we need to rediscover it.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And we're talking here of the very best stories. The very best stories are those which generation after generation has said, oh, there's something powerful here that we need to know. And that has nothing to do with being a bestseller. There are plenty of
mm-hmm.
bestsellers out there which really don't have anything to tell us that is very useful. I mean, right now there is a vogue amongst teenagers and people in their 20s for reading about werewolves and Twilight and vampires.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, and I've read those stories, or as much as I could bear of those stories, and I've seen the movies. And I think many people would agree with me. For instance, in Twilight, what we have is a heroine who is extremely passive. She's always being rescued. What we have
is a view of humanity that is divided into us and them, which
mm-hmm.
I think is very, very basic, a very basic error, and it's not at all a subtle way of looking at things. So the fact that a story exists is wonderful. The fact that it sells a gazillion copies is questionably part of value. But the fact that a story might have survived for a certain amount of time with people saying, oh yes, this is telling me about what it means to be alive, now that is the very best of stories. And
yes,
those stories are part of our Western myth about what it is to be a responsible, alert, compassionate, loving human being and acting from the heart space. It's easy to raise people who act only from the ego space. You just tell them there's only one thing to value, money. And they'll say,
yeah,
okay. And guess what? They won't have any friends because what's the point of friends? They won't have any reasonable contacts because, well, you know, it's all about networking. And so we remove a dimension of ourselves from life. We remove ourselves from being three-dimensional people with real lives to being rather flat, two-dimensional versions of ourselves. I don't think we can do that. I think the world needs us to be the best and fullest possible version of who we can be.
Yeah.
And that's why we need myth. That's why we need to understand myth. And that's why we need ritual.
Yes. So if it feels like this is a challenging task, perhaps, how do we reclaim or rediscover, or maybe even for the first time discover, the pathway to living more fully through ritual?
Mm.
What about
yes.
this notion of personal ritual? Yeah, how do we do this, Allie? Give us a glimpse. We're never going to be able to get at this all in the time. The time is flying by again.
Flying by. It does fly,
it
doesn't it, Susan? We get chatting and it flies by.
Well, that's fine. It's the whole point of what we do here. But, yes, how? And I ask this very personally. I so want to step more fully into all that I can be. And, you know, help me to understand, and through me, everybody else, you know, just what are some steps? What can we do? Where can we start with re-engaging with such an important space?
Well, I think the first step is to recognize that there is something to re-engage with, that there is a dimension that needs to be paid attention to. Some people won't admit that. Some people will go for other people's definitions, religious definitions of what that meaning is. And that is, you know, it's a free world, we can choose whatever we like. But I think that most of the time, what we need is more information about what it is to be alive, which is where literature comes in, great literature. I have found it as a teacher of literature, I have found it immeasurably effective and tremendously moving to talk about some of the great plays and poems and stories that exist in our culture and do that talking more than once. For many of my students, they say, yeah, I read the book. And I say, well, did you read it all? Oh, yeah, yeah. Did you read any parts of it twice? Oh, no, I read the book. What they mean is they skimmed through the book and they got the basic outline of the plot. But then we treat the plot exactly as the way we treat another human being. If we were trying to find out what made that human being tick, we'd say, gosh, you know, you've been through this. Is this from, you know, what does this mean? How do you see it? What could it mean? Where is it taking us? Have I ever felt anything like that? What moved me? You see, moving people into the heart space.
Yes.
And when that happens, the discussion opens up. And who knows, it can open up in a million different ways. But that's all that's required. You see, we are surrounded by powerful, wonderful myths but we've stopped looking for them.
Yes.
And so literature can ask us those questions by saying, here is an example, here are several people, look what they're doing. How does that strike you? How does that strike a 19-year-old, a 20-year-old? Does that correspond to anything in your life? And what we're asking them is to connect through their hearts with, oh yes, you know, I've been angry about that, or I've been sad at that, or I've lost a friend, a relative, and I don't know how to deal with it. And sometimes literature can give us powerful, powerful help and direction with this. And usually it's a very good starting point. That's why literature exists. It's not just that people sat around late at night with nothing to do. You know, come on, they always had something to do. But the power of story, the power of story somehow to entwine itself around one's imagination so that the next day we're saying, oh, I wonder what those characters were doing, thinking. That is basic to who we are as human beings. And of course, Hollywood knows this, and every soap opera knows this. It knows how to keep us on edge as to what the people will do. Now, if I can build on that for a moment, there are quite a lot of programs on television at the moment which seem to be based on crime and solving crime. There's one that I seem to see whenever I go to my gym, and the little monitor is there. It's the FBI profiling criminals and all the rest of it. And it's all terribly exciting. When I'm on the treadmill, it keeps me occupied. But part of me says, you know, I'm really interested that they're doing this, because here is a story that, although it's crammed into a half hour, it's got to develop and be reconciled in a half hour period, it's actually asking quite serious questions about how do people think, and how do we think about how people think, and how do we understand what is acceptable and unacceptable behavior. And suddenly we're into a discussion that can lead us to a heart space. Now, it's not the best way, but it certainly helps. And I think that's another offshoot, as it were, of spiritual hunger. People want story. That's why we go to the television. We see story. There's always a story. Even every sports show is not just about how good someone is on the field. It's the story of how they got to where they are and what they did in the past. There's always story is the key, and it's one of the things that human beings do that other animals can't do. Other animals can communicate about important things a lot better than we can. You know, the intuitive skills of some dogs and cats and higher primates make ours look silly. But human beings tell stories and commit themselves to story. And I think this is one of the things that really helps to make us fully human, to enter into that heart space and to stay there. And when we're there, we grow compassion. There have been quite a lot of studies actually done at the University of Cambridge in England that show that what happens when young people engage in telling story is they grow compassion for seeing other people's viewpoints. And of course, if you don't see compassion, if you don't see other people's viewpoints, if you have no compassion, you know, that's the classic definition of a psychopath. So story, according to the Cambridge researchers, this was published in the Chronicle of Higher Education, so it was a very reliable article. So the option seems to be either we look at story and the heart space and myth and find rituals that work for us by spending some time reading or reading together with children.
Yeah.
If we do that, we can generate this heart space. If we don't honor that space in whatever way we do it, if we don't honor it, we are likely to have some detached, some disaffected, some destructive, and possibly some psychopathic youth coming our way. So we need to create a safe space for the discussions to happen with our young people. And that doesn't happen
nearly enough. And with ourselves, it seems.
And with ourselves. And I mean, it doesn't happen nearly enough. today, you know, technology is wonderful, but the cell phone means that students don't talk to each other between classes.
Absolutely
they all text
true.
Each other about, mm-hmm. well, rarely about the things that perhaps would be most useful. So the avenues of discussion publicly are not open within our schools. What we can do as adults is start these discussions with our children from as early as possible so they get used to this whole business of saying, well, what sort of human behavior is here? What sort of story is this person telling about themselves? Is it the only story? Because we build myths about who we are. We build myths that are either untrue or true, but largely they are untested. So you talk to any teenage boy and say, oh, do you dance? And they say, oh, no, I don't dance. Oh, no, I don't go to parties. No, I don't dance, no. And you ask them, oh, do you sing? Oh, no, don't sing. And yet if you talk to the same kid at the age of 3 saying, sing me a song, you get songs until you told the kid to be quiet. If you said, oh, you like to dance, the kid would be jumping around doing all kinds of crazy moves spontaneously. Somewhere along the way, the private mythology of many of our young people is, I don't sing, I don't dance, I don't express joy openly, I am remote, I'm cool, I am not engaged with other people. That's a myth that people create for themselves based on what they perceive around them, based on advertising too. Ha. So, you know, this is, you ask the question, how can we change this? The first place to start is with conversation, and the second place, I think, is to build on stories that we already have, the stories we need to know, which was the book I published in 2008.
Yes. And it seems we shouldn't be afraid to enter into this space. I will tell you, and I've experienced this, believe me, there is this notion, Alan, that studying the great works of literature, and I've seen this resistance firsthand as an adult, is almost a laughable thing. Like, oh, you're trying to be an intellectual.
mm-hmm.
Or, you know, that there's some, like you have... There's a judgment. It's really hard to explain. It's certainly within the technological culture. You can have all these people with advanced degrees working in certain areas. And, you know, I mean, there's just this resistance to it. Like, it's an intellectual exercise. It's not an intellectual exercise. It's a life exercise.
Exactly.
and I think we need to see that. We've lost touch. And you're helping me to rediscover this. I will say from a very personal sense, my dog's getting excited behind me. I hear her. I can hear her. She's like hearing me get worked up. We've lost touch with something. We've lost touch with the lessons of all of humanity. I mean, what do we think is within story and within history as well? But, you know, within story, it can be so enjoyable to enter into these things. And yet we somehow marginalize it, Alan. We say, oh, you're reading Jane Austen. Just like we laugh about that, you know.
Yeah.
And we don't realize, you know, what's embedded in those tales, or even, you know, going farther back. And so somehow we need to get over that barrier, and we shouldn't be frightened either, because, you know, it seems like there's just so much out there. You know, where do you start? How do you go back into this? And in many ways, you may have never entered into it, depending how your education went, you know. And how in contact you were with certain things throughout your life. So I think that's an important theme. And by the way, we're getting within 5 minutes. I could pull this show a little into overtime. It's up to you. I don't know what your schedule's like. We do it sometimes.
We do.
There is an
I love
overtime
doing it.
Period. Do you want to go into overtime?
Yeah, of course. Of course.
You do. Okay. Well, if your schedule allows, I'll pull you into that. Let me just advise the people listening then. We're going to go into overtime. You know, this is just like the network shows. You hear them, you know, go online and into overtime. Well, this show has that too. We just don't always engage.
So we're like a key baseball match or something.
Yeah. But I hate to just leave this theme. I think we can keep going a little bit
longer. Yeah.
But let me advise the live audience what you need to do.
Okay.
If you're listening to this show live and you want to keep hearing us talking, what you need to do is this show is actually a teleconference in addition to being online. And so all you have to do is call 310-807-5104 and just sit there and listen. So, and you'll be able to hear us. But you have to do it before the live show ends. So you have about 4.5 minutes to call that number if you want to listen live. Or you can just wait until we're done, and the podcast will be out there pretty quick. But I'm giving you that opportunity if you're listening and want to hear live. Okay. So back to this conversation. It's getting at something really important, Alan.
Yeah.
I'm somewhat unusual because I actually had an educational background where I was going down the path of humanities and different things. Well, that's a long story, but it was diverse. I was fortunate to be able to study a lot of things, and I maintained a certain degree of contact with some of those things, but I really did feel a resistance. And here's partially where we let other people influence us too, but there is a kind of resistance in our culture to this concept of we're trying to be an intellectual. No, you're not trying to be an intellectual. Or, you know, you're trying to show how smart you are because you're sitting here reading, you know, the ancient classics. And there really is a mockery that exists, and it's pretty pervasive. It's surprising.
Yeah.
And so, first of all, we can't let what others think of us influence us. That's the obvious
lesson.
No, we
certainly
can't. But once we get beyond that, where do we all join together and say, okay, now is the time to rediscover these things, and that we can do it. We don't have to be absolutely brilliant to pick up some of these stories. I mean, heck, I could probably learn a great deal from Princes, Frogs, and Ugly Sisters, which is sitting right in front of me, and I plan on reading it. So help us to enter into that space when there is this, you know, this feeling of I can't, you know, I was never an English major or, you know, whatever. Or I was, you know, I got a C in English class. How am I going to, that wasn't me, but I know a lot of people who feel that way. You know, what do I really have to learn and how could I even begin with that?
Yes, well, that's exactly it. And perhaps we need a little of the historical context because story making has always been part of human culture at all kinds of levels, whether it's making of ballads or songs or telling of tales like the Grimm Brothers tales, all of which were orally circulating in Europe for hundreds of years before the Grimm Brothers collected them and published the first volume in 1812. And they did that, as I mentioned that date because it's very important, they collected those stories because they said, wait, things are changing, people are going to factories, they're leaving their villages, and the old stories are being lost. We'd better collect them. Because the Grimm brothers, both of them, were serious scholars. I mean, they were they held very high professorships in Berlin at the end of their lives, as well as in other parts of Germany before they moved to Berlin. They were serious scholars. And yet they said, there is something in these tales that helps us see how to live better and more productive lives. And so they started collecting them. But the trouble was the power of historical change had already been put in motion, and that was the Industrial Revolution. So people stopped being in their villages. They stopped telling the tales around the fire at night, which is, you know, Grimm Brothers tales were not just for children. You know, the whole household would have sat around, young and old, and they would have heard them not once but several times. And so as the world changes, our need for story shifted out of the hands of wandering story reciters and was placed more and more in the hands of those people who wanted to print books and didn't care what they printed as long as it made money. Does that remind us of anything?
Oh,
well, yeah.
So much.
You know, the education industry is one, and the entertainment industry is another. They're both industries. Gosh, so they're about more about making money than purveying what needs to be purveyed? Well, actually, yes, and we've already had the brief discussion about Disney, and I know some people love Disney and take their children to Disney World, and it's a lovely place for the children to go. But if you do that, I would also urge you to look at the real versions of the tales, because they tell the truth about what it is to be alive, rather than perhaps the sanitized version that is not going to upset the little kids who enjoy hugging Mickey Mouse and seeing Daffy Duck and all that stuff. So, you know, we are working here against a current of industrialization that really has taken away a lot of things from us, that
yeah.
has now made most Americans, for a very long time now, most Americans have lived in cities. So they don't really see where their food comes from. They don't maybe have much green space around them. They don't interact with nature very much.
Yes.
We accept this. And yet, that is a dreadful thing to do to humanity, not to let them see nature, not to let them know what their food looks like when it's growing, not to be connected with the seasons. That is pretty sad. I sometimes ask my students, there's that wonderful Robert Frost poem called After Apple Picking. And I ask my students first question, I say, well, you know, when do you pick apples? And of a class of 30, perhaps two or three know that you pick them sometime in the fall, because the only time they pick apples is when they go to the supermarket. And then
and it's
mom
always
does
on
it.
The shelf. Yeah,
and
year
it's
round.
Always on the shelf. So,
yes.
So there's this, you know, industrialization has made many things possible. You know, I love things that it's given us, but it's also taken away some really powerful connections to the cycles of the season and to our own sense of mortality, that we too are going to die and turn to dust, and that dust is going to raise another crop or whatever it's going to raise. But we are the same as this. We're not different. And yet industrialization puts us in our little apartments or our little houses or wherever it is we're living and says, this is you, you are separate. That's a relatively recent phenomenon in human history. As I said, we can probably trace it back to about the year 1800 and industrialization hitting Europe for the first time ever. And it's dislocated our sense of myth and ritual and all of the life-giving connections that those things will give us. You know, if I were to ask your listeners, well, which of you has been on a pilgrimage, I'd be very surprised if out of all your listeners I got more than a handful of people replying that they had been on a pilgrimage. And yet, not so long ago, pilgrimages, maybe very short ones, just to a local shrine, or long ones as far as Jerusalem, pilgrimages were an accepted way of people thinking about their souls. Now, if I go into a classroom today and say to my students, you know, hello, class, I'd like you to think about your souls, I think I'd probably get a very negative reaction. I haven't been brave enough to try it, or at least not in the first class. After a while, we do talk about what it means to be alive. So, this is a trend. We've had things taken away from us. Now we're realizing the price of having those stories, those myths removed from us. And I think we're beginning to ask, as a culture, we're beginning to say, I think we need them back. Can we dig them up? Can we can we resuscitate them? And of course we can. They're still in books. They're still available. We just have to learn how to be responding to them in a constructive way.
You know something, Alan, when you talk about country life, there was something else I was going to bring up earlier from my own life, because I spent some time in the Ozarks in my life.
Yeah.
And I will tell you, Alan, they have not lost touch with a certain type of ritual that we all have lost. And although they don't exactly have country dances like, you know, you think of in some of these, I think of English tales. I don't know.
Yeah.
Different. I don't know. They have a sense of it. And it was really interesting. They have a sense of community that we've lost. Because, you know, when you're out in those spaces out there, very open spaces, where I used to go, the closest town, if you drove fast, very fast, on a country road, frighteningly fast, on a curvy road, which they do, by the way.
I know it well.
it was 20 minutes away, but, you know, if you drove like a normal person or a cautious person, you were looking at least 30. And so, and it was beautiful out there. But the thing that, and I was connected to many things, and actually I spent time there during a challenging part of my life. I was called to be there, and I believe it was part of my healing. But what I observed was they still come together as community. They will have, you know, they'll come together at the local hall. And they'll, you know, they'll bring, it's an interesting, there are rituals to it. And it's like country music, you know, and it's something they do. And I know in cities people will go out dancing or whatever, but this was not the same. There was something about this, Alan, that you could feel there was a timelessness to it. And there was even a history. The people that I was with, they had a history in their family, generations of running, you know, they played the violin or the fiddle, you know. And music was an important element here as well. And how it joined them together. And do you know, Alan, as I looked at this, I found myself in a kind of mourning. Well, maybe both types of mourning, day, because the light came on, but no, a type of grieving for the modern world that we've lost this. We never take a break, number one. These people live incredibly busy lives, and yet they would take a break, and they would come together as community and, you know, have this regular experience of music and dancing and joy, you know, intergenerational dancing. I mean, we only see that at weddings usually.
That's right, yeah.
You know, where maybe we do the chicken dance or something. and something's been lost. And I saw this long ago, and I think thematically it's very much related to the themes of your book.
Yes, definitely. Well, that's such a lovely example, isn't it? Because music and communion and gathering together, and even, you know, the preparing and eating of traditional foods, these are things that build communion and give one a sense of rootedness to a society and a way of thinking and being. One thinks and does things pretty much the way one's neighbors do, at least about the big things in life. You might vote for somebody different, but you value the human beings around you roughly the same way. You value the land the same way. And these things are under constant erosion. I'm sorry, you know, nowadays, can we even talk about a farming community when some of the large farms are several thousand acres and it takes one man with a combine harvester, and he hires another man to drive the grain truck seasonally. Is there really a rural community for many people anymore? I doubt it.
They are very rare, and I, you know, just happened to be in a pocket where they existed. And, you know, I lived some of the rest of my life, well, during that same time of my life, I lived in Kansas, where the big industrial farms are taking over. I mean, there are still some family farms. I mean, in the Ozarks, it's all family farms for the most part still. But it's we're losing that. And, I mean, there are still family farms in Kansas, too, but you do begin to see the industrialization of farmland. And in doing so, we are losing. It's sad. It's very sad. I mean, at multiple levels. We can't get into all the themes of this, but from the sense of ritual and community, you know that it's severing something that's really important. And so then we feel lost. We feel lost when you know, we live in these communities now where we hardly even know our neighbors. You know, maybe, you know, I connected to them at the parade before I ever knew them, or I didn't know them well, and yet we were all there. And yet, so there we had something, some element there. Many communities don't have parades, so you don't even, you don't have that. And you know, again, you know, I can feel this yearning that we have for connectedness. And there's a theme in your book, just that, that being, wanting connectedness, wanting things that will connect us together.
Yes, exactly. One of the fastest growing areas of mental unhealth in this country is, of course, depression. And people are depressed for various reasons, some of them very reasonable and some of them chemical reasons. But a great deal of depression that is treated comes from people reporting that they don't feel connected to anything or anybody in a vital way.
Yeah.
And when I'm talking about the figures here, it's 1 in 4 Americans will seek help for depression. And that's not counting those who drink themselves into oblivion or who otherwise medicate. 1 in 4 of us. So this is a crisis in our civilization. You know, the listeners may say, oh, you know, it's Susan and Alan chatting about something. It doesn't affect me. Well, it does. It really does. My students, God bless them. You know, I love them dearly. And I'm always surprised at how many people at a young age are suffering from forms of depression and are being treated for it, and forms of anxiety. And I think anxiety is another of those products of not feeling secure in your environment. And who could say they felt secure in the environment most of us see around us? Who can really say, oh, this is a nice, secure place, and it won't be changing too much in the next 10 years or whatever.
Yeah.
Who can say that when dad gets laid off because of a recession that's not his fault? When developers come in and bulldoze a whole city block that was full of beautiful older houses because they're going to put in, you know, great high-rises and high-priced condos, which is certainly happening here around Boston. You know, it's not against the law. It's don't get me wrong. And yet something can often be lost, a sense of neighborhood, a sense of connection. And these are things that human beings absolutely have to have. These are not optional extras that we feel connected. If we don't have them, we become destructive. We become more prone to crime, more prone to self-destructive behaviors. We know this. We've known this for a long, long time. If you want an extreme example, just look at what happened to the Native American Indians. They were shoved off their land, shoved away from their native folk ways, from everything they understood. And so when alcohol came along, guess what? Many of them did and still do drink themselves to death because of a mythic loss. When we lose our myths, we lose part of our hearts. And when we lose our hearts, we die inside. And so drinking yourself to death seems to be a fairly logical way forward. And for those of us who've been to Indian reservations and seen what it's like and talked to people, it's a second Holocaust right there, that these people have suffered. The first Holocaust
has been
removed. Yeah. So this is not... Sorry?
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, I've observed it firsthand, too, in the Pacific Northwest here.
Yes,
the most desolate part of Oregon. I mean, right next to the Army Depot where they have toxic waste, although they didn't when they first were there. Now the toxic waste is there. This is where the Indian reservation is.
Yes.
And even before they put toxic waste there, it must have seemed like whatever form of hell they believe in, if they have a form, although I don't know if they do. But
I mean,
compared to the beautiful, lush, I mean, where I live on the other side of Oregon, where it's lush and green and bountiful, they say the Native Americans here never fought each other because the resources were so abundant. And yet they were moved to this wasteland. And I'm sure their lives, I mean, I can't even imagine what, I mean, we learn about this through history, but to observe it. And, you know, as I'm saying this, I see a kind of analogy here that, you know, here we are in the modern world, many of us in our everyday lives, we're living in this wasteland, or it feels that way.
Yeah.
And yet, is it possible, Alan, could it be that, you know, the lush rainforest where I live, symbolically, is only a step away, that we can recreate it, we can step into it again, we don't have to be in that wasteland, and thankfully, it's accessible to us.
Yes, well, that's beautifully put. I do believe that for those who are suffering from soul loss, nature is perhaps the best restorative of all. Not always. Yeah. Some people even can't respond to the beauties of nature, but that is what will bring us back to our sense of what it is to be human. Beautiful parks. There's a reason the Park Service exists, because something different happens to us when we enter a park. If we let that space work on us, it shows us that we are more and different than we thought we were. We are not all of our ego concerns about, I have to do this, I have to please that person, I have to buy that. We are not that. We can be something else. And that, I think, is when we realize, if we realize it at all, that we have souls that need feeding.
Yeah.
And so what you've said, I think, is absolutely on to the point. We do need the great outdoors. We do need nature. And then we need stories to feed that sense, that arising sense we have of being more than just a social security number and an income bracket.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, something you say within your book that is very meaningful to me is that we can be connected to the mystical, to the transcendent world, and you know, and that we can incorporate that as well into our experience. You know, that's the next, that's kind of the lush forest that's there for us if we only enter into it, no matter where we are. And by the way, just time wise, I don't want to drag this out. I don't know what your schedule is. I'm kind of aiming for wrapping up at 90 minutes. How about
okay,
that?
Okay,
that
sounds good.
Good to you? Okay, I figure I better do a check there to see how we're doing time wise. So that gives us about 12 minutes left. I wonder, you know, on this show, Alan, and many of the guests, because, and I make no secret of it, because I've ventured into the mystical in my experience, we do explore that in various ways. And so And I know I have a lot of listeners who are very interested in that aspect of life. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit to that in terms of ritual and myth, how it takes us to that transcendent place.
Well, the importance of ritual and myth, as I have been saying, I think, is that it lets us know that we are not the only people who have trod this path.
Yes.
Whatever path we are on, we are not the first, we're not the only, and we're not alone. And I think that is a tremendously important thing about ritual, whether you're talking about a bar mitzvah or a funeral service. A funeral service is constructed, as is a bar mitzvah, to let us know that this is a point of transition for everyone. In the bar mitzvah, you're welcoming a young adult, or a bat mitzvah, you're welcoming a young woman into the community. And in a funeral service, you are arranging your thoughts differently about the person who is leaving the community. And you're also considering what it means to leave the community. Just as in a bar mitzvah or a communion, you're forced to think about what it means to be part of the community of people who do things a certain way.
Yeah.
So these are actually transcendent moments when we begin to look at ourselves as creatures who are going through one of life's turning points. And that, of course, is why I write about the six archetypes, which I've described in Stories We Need to Know, because it seems to me that if we look at life and literature, I looked at 3,000 years worth of the Western world's literature, what we see is that there are six life passages, if you will, or turning points, ways that we can change, and these are mirrored in all the great stories, the great religious stories, the Bible, the Torah, all the Buddhist scriptures, and even the Hindu scriptures, and certainly in the Quran. There are these six archetypes that we are invited to move through. Most people don't know about these archetypes, which is why I had to write the book. Most people have never heard of them, but they're definitely there, and they have been since story writing began. And I think when we look at things this way, that is a transcendent experience when we say, oh, there is something I am here on earth to do and something I am here on earth to learn, so that when my time comes to die, I can leave this life peacefully. And I think that's really important, because death is something we're very confused about in the United States and in the West generally. We have all these wonderful drugs to keep people alive long after, in a slightly different era, we might have said, you know, it's probably best to let them die peacefully.
Yeah.
And if you talk to old people, many of them say, well, I don't know how many years I've got left, but I want those years to be quality. And when the quality diminishes below a certain level, you know, please unplug the machine. Well, if only it were that simple, you know. Law courts tend to get in the way of that. So the six archetypes are a way of looking at the transcendent values of myth and literature and story in our culture, so that we can perhaps begin to consider, oh, is there more for me to do? Because in my experience, people don't grow and change unless they see a persuasive reason to grow and change. Otherwise, they just grow up to do whatever it is their parents did. And that's fine. But there may be more that they have to learn and do. So I think that would be the way I would answer the question about the transcendent values that we're missing because we've lost our myths.
Yes. And let me add, just as a note, that I very much think that it would be appropriate in a future show, I think we're starting to lead into that, where we really do explore these archetypes, because to really fully understand your work thematically. You know, we're really creating a series here is what we're doing. It's,
I'm happy.
I'm perfectly happy. It's
oh, good.
Really a delight to have you on the show. So, yeah, it is. And we really get to some important things, I think, that are very accessible to people. These are not inaccessible. And, you know, these things are available to us, and you make them approachable, and that's important, Alan. Anyway, that's one thing is that I will say, sort of as a sneak preview, at some point, I hope I can invite you to come back, Alan, to talk about your archetypes. Wonderful.
I'd be honored, Susan. Thank you. That's a very. I'd look forward to that very much.
Yes, but then also. In response to what you said is that, you know, so much I feel when just reflecting upon it, okay, we're at 5 minutes, you know, we are called to look at the greater meaning in our lives. And I think so many of us, I know this is certainly the case with me, I mean, we're being called to incredibly fulfilling paths. You know, if we just open up to what is possible, and you know, I think that we really can, even if it comes later in life. You know, not that I'm that old yet, but I'm not a 20-year-old anymore. It seems like often it comes to people at about my age. Is that we can, you know, really fill whatever years we have left with such fulfilling pursuits. And,
and
you know, I feel the promise of that. And then we just get up every day, you know, just using the term from another book, living rejoicing, you know, that we really can live rejoicing.
Yeah.
And I'm beginning to feel that. And it's a wonderful thing. And I can only hope that more of our listeners can begin to step into that space, because it's what life can be all about.
Absolutely. And
yes.
Sorry, you were going to say, I interrupted
no,
you.
No, I want you to speak. Go ahead.
Well, yes. One of the remarkable things about being alive is that we're continually invited into this wonderful space. I call it a journey, actually. We're continually invited to make this journey to find more depth and more meaning. And if we do that, we take on perhaps a little bit of a difficult work, but it's eminently worth it. And we're quite at liberty to refuse to do it. The trouble is, as I've noticed with my counseling clients and with people I've spoken with generally, the trouble is if one refuses this invitation to move through the archetypes, to find greater depth, to find more connection, it tends to ambush us later in life.
Yeah.
And it's called sometimes the midlife crisis. And you know, stereotypically, men go out and buy fast machinery and get strange haircuts and divorce their perfectly wonderful wives and take up with younger women and so on, that sort of stereotype. And I see so much of that, and I think to myself, okay, that's the action that this person took because he, and I'll stay with the male descriptor at the moment, he is afraid somehow that he missed out on something in his life, and what he missed out on was spiritual growth.
Yeah.
Now, for women, I think it's slightly different. I think sometimes women can become over-entwined with their children as a substitute for spiritual growth. And that certainly happens. I've certainly seen, all of us, I'm sure, can think of many examples of that, of becoming too entwined with the children and literally not being able to let them go for fear of the empty nest. Well, it's not fear of the empty nest, it's fear of emptiness inside that's really the problem. So we're all invited on this path over and over again, and sometimes tragedy strikes and asks us to think again. Sometimes we lose something, and that gives us the shock that we need, perhaps, to say, well, what's all this about? And if we can't come up with some sort of answer that connects us to other people, that's when depression strikes. So we always have a choice. We always have a choice. But if we make the wrong choice, we'll know because we'll feel dreadful. And believe me, I shouldn't laugh or make fun of this.
Not funny.
There are plenty of people who look around and say, my life isn't working. My life just isn't working for me. And, you know, that's a sad statement, but it's also a tremendously hopeful statement, because what follows on from that is, okay, therefore something's missing. What is it? And that's when we can start to build.
Yes. Such important lessons there, Alan. Well, you know, it's not going to cut us off. I'm not going to hit the button at 90 minutes, but we're aiming for that. And I am going to say we can wrap up now. But, you know, let me just say once again, thank you. Thank you for being here, Alan.
Susan, my eternal gratitude to you. I love our conversations. And you do such a wonderful job getting, I think, all of your guests' wonderful information out to a world that is hungry for it. So we should all, I think, be deeply grateful for the wonderful work you do. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that. And, you know, it's a joy. I mean, all I can say is, you know, it's truly a joy to be a kind of bridge, really.
Yeah. Well, the bridge builder.
I've been that for a while, it seems, and it just keeps coming through in different ways. And I will say, no, it truly is a joyous path to be on, to be able to bring such voices into the world, you know, more fully in whatever way I can. And so, and you have a very, very powerful voice, a very compassionate voice, Alan, that, you know, people really can benefit from hearing, and so much that you've written about too. And you know, I hope to continue to explore this in our Dr. Alan Hunter series, I guess.
I'll look forward to that.
So thanks again, Alan.
Thank you, Susan.
Again, let me remind people that your website is on the page, and it's alanhunter.net.
That's where they can
learn all about you.
And in case, perhaps I should point out that it's Alan is A-L-L-A-N, Hunter.
Oh, very important, very important. I should know that. That name has many different spellings. Also, I invite people to follow. Tell us your Twitter account. I'm going to put it out on mine again, because I know you're just getting started out there on Twitter.
Yes. And, it's a bit new to me.
Yes, and it does take some time to get it going. I know that. But I really invite people to follow you on Twitter. Tell them your Twitter account again.
Yes, it's Alan, A-L-L-A-N-G, Hunter 1, just the numeral 1, on Twitter. And that's where I can be found, also at my website. And the books, of course, are on Amazon and at my publisher's Fintorn Press. So there, you can even read the opening chapters of most of them, so you can get a flavor of how I write and whether you want to read further.
Well, I think they get a real feel for your voice just through your speaking on this show. So I think many of them, I encourage them to explore your work.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Alan. And until next time, I look forward to having you back.
All right. Well,
take care.
You too.
All right. Thank you. And I'm just going to wrap up the show real quick with a couple of notes. First of all, if you want to learn about this show, go to frontierbeyondfear.com. That's also where you can support this show. This show is listener supported. This show comes straight from my heart. And, you know, I welcome support. And if people are out there feel so guided to assist the show, there is that opportunity on frontierbeyondfear.com. And also, I should give a quick show note. The next show is actually based on a synchronistic meeting I had at an expo some months ago I met an author who is in the Pacific Northwest, and her name is Carolyn R. Prescott, and she wrote a novel for young people that she actually wanted to be a deeper exploration than the typical Twilight-type books, the vampire books that are out there. And that culture is very pervasive in the Northwest, because actually many of those books are based in the Northwest. And so she wrote a book called Twin Flames, which she brought to my table at an expo some months ago. And there were just all these synchronicities around this book. And I'm really looking forward to inviting her on the show to talk about this concept of twin flame. She's also going to explore Native American spirituality and also dramatic spiritual emergences, which is there was a real synchronicity there, certain themes we've already explored in this show. So she will be here Tuesday, July 16th at 1 p.m. Pacific and 4 p.m. Eastern. So I welcome you back to the show, and please do explore the podcast. Alan Hunter's been on this show several times, and I'm invited to get a page out there of all his shows, but it's going to be on the FrontierBeyondFear.com page as well. So FrontierBeyondFear.com. If you go to that page, I will have a link to every one of his shows so that you can explore what he's told us so far and the kinds of conversations we've had. So, again, everyone, thank you so much for being here. I so appreciate the community developing around this show, which continues to expand. So I hope that this show is really helping you with your journeys, because that is my intent. So peace be with you all, wherever this show finds you. Take care, everyone.